Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Philosopher Susan Neiman says the world may be a confusing place full of clashing values, beliefs, and interests, but there is still such a thing as moral clarity. The Bible's Abraham had it, she says. The ancient wanderer Odysseus had it. Politicians on the left and right in Washington, Tel Aviv, and Tehran claim to have it. But a lot of liberals, she says, have lost it, or at least lost its vocabulary, concepts, and conviction. Time for everyone to bone up, she says. This hour, On Point, one philosopher's take on politics, morality, and values, with an eye on the November election. Joining me now from New York is Susan Neiman, Dr. Susan Neiman. She has taught philosophy at Yale and Tel Aviv universities. She's now director of the Einstein Forum in Potsdam, Germany. Her new book is called Moral Clarity, a Guide for Grown-Up Idealists. Susan Neiman, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dr. Neiman.
And I want to welcome our newest listeners at public radio stations WGTU-FM in Fort Myers, Florida, and WMKO-FM in Marco, Florida. Great to have you with us as well. Susan Neiman, I've never seen this bumper sticker, but it might be on the back of your car reading your book. Metaphysics matter, you say. It matters what our metaphysics are, but I'm not sure people day in and day out think in those terms. What do you mean?
You know, metaphysics is a long and intimidating word for something really very simple that we think about all the time. We think about what's real, what is, and what ought to be, and what the differences between those things are. So this campaign in particular, certainly the beginning parts of the campaign, spent a lot of time talking about idealism and realism, two ideas that particularly come up in foreign policy debates. That's just metaphysics.
You talk about moral clarity, and you've got a real critique in here for the U.S. political left, but also of the right, I guess, in a way. The right you see as having drifted toward a kind of, I don't know, almost a fundamentalist interpretation of morality. The left having drifted away from the language of morality at all. You take both both poles and would like to point them back to the Old Testament in the Bible and one of the stories of Abraham there, Abraham's in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is very illuminating as you tell it and not necessarily in the way that people typically quickly think. To take us into that.
It's a very surprising way of looking at the Bible, but it's all right there if you take the trouble to open it up. Let me start just a couple of steps back. There are not too many books that actually have a particular day on which they began to be written. This one did. I started writing on November 3rd, 2004. Mm. And I was, like many people, dismayed, not simply by the fact that we were in for another 4 years of a Bush administration, which had already lowered this country's standing in the eyes of the whole world, but that we were in for it because a number of people had said Bush had moral clarity. Okay, so there are two ways to go with this. You ask, well, how could there be moral clarity in an administration that had lied us into a war, condoned torture for the first time in centuries? And you could say, well, all right, a lot of people out there in the heartland were simply fooled, bamboozled into believing that something called moral values counted more than their own interests. That's one line that a lot of progressives have taken. Mm. I felt it was much more important to take those claims seriously, that people were looking for moral clarity. They might settle for moral simplicity, but it seemed to me that progressives needed to clean up their own house and look at what we've been doing wrong, why we're not comfortable with moral language. And I think one thing that you'll hear from both sides is, well, you can't really have a resounding moral vocabulary unless you base it on religion, and everything else is a little shaky. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very common belief in both left and right. Mm-hmm. So the next move is to say, well, let's actually go to the Bible and see if that's the case. And one of the great stories in the Bible is the story of Abraham at Sodom and Gomorrah. God tells Abraham that he's about to wipe out the two cities because they're sinful. Incidentally, the sin in question is not fornication. It's not homosexuality. Mm. It's the Sodomites' demand to drag out and gang rape two guests whom the good-hearted Lot had offered to shelter. This is a pretty serious sin in on anybody's book.
To gang rape them to death.
Correct. To gang rape them to death, and then there are some interpretations that go further that say that the Sodomites actually had a law saying that all strangers should be gang raped to death. So this is pretty serious sinning. Nevertheless, Abraham hears about that, and he says, wait a sec, what if there are innocent people in the city? Surely the king of all justice, the judge of all the world, can't be in favor of killing the innocent along with the guilty.
And he doesn't just say this to himself, musing along a country lane. He says this in the Old Testament telling to God.
He says it to God. And one of the things I love about this passage is you can feel his fear. He knows that God could wipe him out in a second, and this is not a democracy. This is not a situation in which subordinates can simply, voice their opinions and get away with it. So it takes a great deal of courage for Abraham to say, wait a sec, God, you're actually about to violate the law of justice. And God says, well, okay, if I can find 50 innocent people, I will spare Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm. And he speaks up again, Abraham, and he says, well, wait a second, you're not going to get pedantic about it, right? What if there are only 45 righteous people?
He's dickering with God here.
Bargaining with God. He gets them all the way down to 10 righteous people. And there's three things about this story that I think are tremendously important. One is that Abraham is simply pleading for the rights and the lives of innocent people. These are not people who are related to him. It's not people he knows. They're not members of his tribe.
So it's a principled defense.
It's a principled universalistic defense. Mm-hmm. Humankind in any, whether it's my tribe or your tribe or anybody else, humankind needs to be protected. Okay. The second point is that he's scared. The third point, so he's risking his life and he knows it. The third point is that he doesn't think you can get moral clarity by simply naming a general principle once and for all. He sees that there's a question that needs to be dealt with in detail. Okay. 45, 40, 35, how many innocent lives, what's acceptable collateral damage? And that's a very, very important concept here because what's shown here is that collateral damage is criminal, and it's certainly just as criminal as rape.
But it seems to me almost as important as any of these is that he brings a human sense of justice into even a negotiation, a dialogue with the Almighty. In that way, kind of asserts, even in the heart of the Bible, the heart of the Old Testament, some sort of a human sense that is ready to get into a discourse, a back and forth with religion, with God.
Thank you very much. That was going to be my final point, and I agree that it is the most important point. The most important point is even if you're Abraham, even if you're the father of all three of the Abrahamic faiths and you have a direct line to God, God is not the person who gives you your fundamental sense of morality. You have a sense of morality. You have a sense of justice that is so independent that you can actually argue with God and give him lessons in ethics. Okay, there are interpretations that said that actually Abraham was that God was testing Abraham here. But it doesn't really matter. The idea that's so important for people now on both the left and the right to see is morality doesn't come from religion. Okay, even at the beginning of the Bible, religion is one way that some people have of expressing their sense of morality, but it's not the source of it. Okay, so that whether or not you're religious, you still need to think for yourself. Being religious is not going to solve your ethical problems.
And Jack Beatty, here we have Susan Neiman kind of within that, exhorting the left to not walk away from this language of moral clarity, to not imagine that it can't be found, articulated, achieved, championed.
Yes, and especially in the realm of economics, social justice should be the preeminent value, or it's certainly a value-charged rhetoric that the left uses. But, I think the contrasting story to this is the one on Abraham and Isaac, as you point out, Professor, that is the situation on Mount Moriah where he's ready to sacrifice his son because God commands it, that sort of fealty to a command is the fundamentalist view of morality. And as Kant said, my gosh, whoever was talking to Abraham in that case, it couldn't have been God. God wouldn't have asked for such a monstrous thing. And I think you make a very good distinction. That's one kind of fundamentalist idea of morality. God commands I do this. I won't question. I won't think. I'm just going to be the instrument, no matter what it may be. And you're saying, well, really, that's putting God first. Morality should come first.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Susan Neiman, those air quotes, the kind of sense of distance around some of these sort of basic vocabulary of moral clarity, you've had about enough of, you write.
Oh, I've had more than enough of it. And I think once people start focusing on how often they put their hands in the air, they'll have enough of it themselves. I think it's a sign of two things. One is a sign of embarrassment, right? Embarrassment about using words that sound kitschy, corny, sappy, good, noble, evil. And so it's an attempt to say something without really saying it. Mm. I think that when you look at the current political situation and why someone like Sarah Palin is getting traction, even though neither she nor the people who support her have a worked out conception of either, of political morality, they're not afraid to use the words. They may not be able to fill them out coherently, but they can take them in their mouths. And that resonates with an awful lot of people who say, wait a second, what are we afraid of? Now, let me be fair and I'm a resolute progressive myself, my own friends, colleagues, allies. Mm. I think that we began at a certain point in the 60s realizing that people had been naive about certain kinds of universal moral claims, that some people, peoples of color, non-European people, women were getting left out of a lot of moral and political discourse. So there was an attempt to rectify that. But that coupled with the fact that there's still this persistent belief that you can't have real morality unless you have a religious foundation, has left progressives with very little to stand on. And they've left the most powerful conceptual weapons in the wrong hands.
The most powerful conceptual weapons because the language of morality, of moral clarity, has such power on the human ear.
Sure.
And you point to a lot of turf to stand on, and I wish you'd begin to point it out. When you're kind of laying out almost a reading list here for anybody who wants to steer toward moral clarity. You gave us a couple of lessons from the Old Testament and the Bible, but where else do you direct those who you're sort of encouraging to revive their relationship with moral vocabulary, moral clarity?
Sure. First of all, let me just emphasize that there are lessons all over the Bible, and not just in the first book, in the stories of Abraham. And I urge even people who aren't religious to take those very seriously. There's a reason why that language resonates. There's a reason why they're classics. Another place that I think is incredibly important is to look back at Homer, considered to be the Greek's Bible. Mm. And if you put the Iliad and the Odyssey together, you can actually come up with notions of modern heroism that are not simply military heroism. Okay, it's very easy to think that the willingness to die for a cause makes you a hero, makes you someone that we should admire. But as a matter of fact, it's much harder to live for a cause. And if you go back and look at the Greeks and you compare Odysseus, who was the first modern hero in the first modern novel, you will see bravery, you'll see humanity, you'll see an ability to look at the details, not just to engage in high-flown rhetoric, but to actually think about, you know, who's getting fed and what's a lesser of two evils, how to avoid things. You also see great love and a very moving tale of grown-up love, not not something else. So Homer is another place that I go to look for sources of moral clarity without simplicity, by the way.
Plenty of ambiguity there, which makes it resonate for us as moderns.
Precisely. But the main foundation that I think we need to look towards for moral clarity is the much maligned Enlightenment. Now, when we talk about the Enlightenment, I think we should be really clear. What we're talking about is the foundation of modernity. And if you look very, very broadly at what kinds of bases we have for thinking, there are really only three. You can defend the modern. You can look at the past with a kind of reactionary nostalgia and say, oh, we're all going to hell in a handbasket and it would be nice to go back to the old days. Or you can become postmodern and with a sort of overdose of irony say, well, you know, it doesn't really matter and there aren't really anything to value at all, okay? Mm-hmm. Those are the choices. So given those are the choices, I think we need to take another look at the Enlightenment. There are a number of myths about the Enlightenment, and one of the things that this book is devoted to doing is undermining all of them. The first is that the Enlightenment only cared about reason and devalued emotion, passion, sentiment, more human traits. Okay. The second is that the Enlightenment believed that human beings were benevolent, fundamentally good, and getting better. The third is that the Enlightenment was fundamentally anti-religious. And the fourth is that the Enlightenment believed that progress is necessary. And I, you know, any time you open up a magazine, unfortunately, even sometimes fairly serious or supposedly serious scholars like Isaiah Berlin, who wrote a lot of popular philosophy that people often quote, an awful lot of people believe these cliches about the Enlightenment.
Susan, hold the thought for a moment, because I want to wade into those. But, Jack, I wanted to just get your take first on really the notion here that what's in order is a kind of refresher course for a lot of progressives that would help them drop the air quotes on issues of moral clarity and maybe a stiff dose of Enlightenment philosophy, not to mention Homer and the Bible along the way. How about the starting premise, Jack? What do you think?
Well, you know, I admire this book a lot, but I do think, Professor, that you too readily take the right at its own professions. I mean, conservatives say, we believe in values, we believe in morals, you point to Sarah Palin. You said she's talking about morals. Well, is she talking about morals, or is she mostly lying about her record? You know, she wants to ban abortions in cases of rape and incest. How is that moral? Her town, Wasilla, was the only town in Alaska that required rape victims to pay for the kits used to establish the physical evidence of the crime. How is that moral? The point is, you can't accept conservatives on their own say-so. Really, what they often do, it seems to me, is employ the rhetoric of pelvic righteousness. That's what their morality seems to come down to. And on the other side, it doesn't seem to me to be materialistic in some grad grind-like way for progressives to talk about issues of economics as issues of justice. What could be more fundamental than to say, you know, yes, man does not live by bread alone, but how the world's bread is divided up, that is a moral question that goes right to the basis of what kind of society we live in. And you could argue that it's a profounder moral question than issues of pelvic deviance or sin or whatever they want to call it. So I think you're too readily conceding the straw men. They're about values. Progressives are about materialism. Oh, we can't win. We have to start talking about values too. Yes, but why not talking about the values of materialism?
Susan Neiman, I hear you as very, very critical but less belittling of conservative morality. But how do you respond?
That's correct, Jack. I couldn't agree with you more. And as a matter of fact, in the chapter on evil, I decided very deliberately not to take standard examples that we're all used to, but to take the Bush administration, not simply as an example of hypocrisy or badness. But I talk about three cases in which I think he deserved or his administration deserved the word evil. And I talk about how to analyze that. So I couldn't agree with you more that plenty of people, whether it's Palin, whether it's Rove, are using fake values claims to cover over a series of misdeeds. Granted. You know what my problem is, Jack? We used all those arguments in 2004. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, one of the great achievements of the Enlightenment was to abolish torture. And the moment that this administration allowed the United States to torture prisoners, we lost our moral credibility in the eyes of the world. So, you know, I mean, even that issue, forget about social justice, forget about a whole mess of things that they're doing wrong. That, for me, is rock-bottom evil, okay? And all the Abu Ghraib scandals came out in the spring of 2004, and I truly thought, as many people did, that given things like that, given all the evidence that the administration had lied its way into a war, that exactly the sorts of arguments you just brought up would sway the nation, and they didn't. So for me, the point was to go back to the drawing board and say, before I dismiss half of the country, or at least half of the country who voted, as sheer, you know, idiots who can't see beyond their noses, what is it that they're missing in the arguments of my side? And that's what I've tried to provide. And I really do think that we have to take that seriously.
But you don't dismiss half of the country as sheer idiots in this book. You spend a lot of time kind of whacking progressives around for a blind spot on where we began here, on some of the vocabulary of kind of a moral education. You describe them. Jack raises the social justice issue, but you describe on many fronts kind of abdication here. And I hear, at the same time as there's tough criticism, there's a line of applause that runs through this book to conservatives for keeping the language of morality alive, even if you don't always agree with the interpretation.
That is correct. And look, I you can say it's a fundamental Kantian principle, but it's really what you try to teach your kids when they're little. You know, that the first moral rule is you clean up your own mess, okay? Mm. If everybody cleaned up their own mess, we'd all be in really good shape. So the mess in my house, as somebody who is a daughter of a woman who was very engaged in the civil rights movement in Atlanta, and you know, that's where I come from. Mm-hmm. It's resolutely progressive universalist since I was a child. I felt that the one thing I could do with the philosophical skills that I had I had received and honed in my own education, the useful thing that I could do was to say, hey, let's clean up our own house first rather than point to the others and see how many people we can win by finding common denominators. And frankly, when I started this book, I had the word grown-up idealist. I'd had that for a long time when I was teaching Kant back at Yale. I did not even dream that a candidate would come along who so well fit my ideal of a grown-up idealist as Barack Obama. And I think he's been doing a terrific job.
Look, I want to dip into those.
Precisely. Sorry, just one. In appealing to a moral common denominator that people across different political lines can share.
Let's go to our listeners for some real-world questions, observations on moral clarity in Vergennes, Vermont. Evan's calling. Evan, you're on the air.
I'm here. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm wondering if we could bring into the discussion today the very immediate concern of Troy Davis, who is a black man scheduled to be executed today. And there are a lot of questions still about his guilt. There are a lot
This is for the 1989 murder of a Savannah police officer, Troy Davis, 39 years old. Jimmy Carter, Bob Barr, the Pope have all called for the state parole board to reduce that sentence to life. What do you see there, Evan?
Well, it ties in with the conversation today and also about sort of people not being able to see what's beyond their nose in America, your comment just a second ago. Also, it's a part of the media. I'm a Barack Obama supporter, but I'm also wondering how I don't hear from him commenting on this, and almost like a fear, people wanting to keep themselves at an arm's distance from this. And also, the first today he's being scheduled for execution. The first I heard of it was yesterday on NPR, and how these sort of huge moral issues aren't front and center. I realize we have a faltering economy, but this to me is a humongous issue about the state of America. And I just am wondering if there could be some comments on this today from Jack.
Evan, thank you. Susan, first to you. Evan wishes, I guess, your candidate, it turns out, Barack Obama, was putting this particular issue more front and center, even with an economy in crisis. Do you think moral issues are getting enough attention in the political campaign with everything else that's going on?
Not entirely, and just a word about this scheduled execution, which is appalling. Interestingly enough, I live in Berlin, but I'm on so many lists that I got several petitions for several weeks now and have been signing them. I think it's outrageous that people who claim to care about a right to life are not speaking out against the scheduled execution of a man whose guilt hasn't even been established. So I completely agree with you, and I don't know what else to say about that. Obama has taken positions that I don't agree with, and he hasn't spoken up on issues that I think he should speak up on. The only thing that I can say is that I think the Republican machine is so vile. The sex education ad being perhaps the most egregious example of that I understand that he feels he has to watch every word and that the capital punishment issue is a big one. I think it's a shame. I wish that when we talked about the right to life, we broaden that question in many ways to speak about capital punishment, to speak about collateral damage, to speak about what happens to babies after they're born.
Let's get a call from Cortland, Virginia, and Stan. Stan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to ask the point. Your guest made a good point that our morals are not really ingrained into us at birth. They're taught to us, and we learn them as we grow. And so can you really use moral clarity to, like, pick a presidential candidate? As would a Christian candidate have the same moral upbringing as, say, an atheist independent candidate? Like the evangelical right is known as a moral majority, and they came out strong to get George Bush 8 years. And I don't know if the morals were good or bad, but the results aren't very good.
Stan, we've got it. I appreciate your question. Susan Neiman, what do you say to Stan?
Well, this is one of the reasons why I use the story of Abraham at Sodom and Gomorrah, is to suggest that even if you are religious and even if you're have a direct line to God, that's not where you get your morals from. So I think that many people who are Christians may believe that the Bible is, gives them all that they need to know. But if you actually read the Bible, it's a quite complicated book and it needs to be interpreted. So my view is, yes, we do learn morality, but we have certain very fundamental moral convictions and intuitions about innocent life, about justice, about people not being punished for other people's crimes. And those are really independent of whether or not you're an atheist or whether you're a believer.
You look to Adam Smith, Hume, Rousseau, Kant, Enlightenment philosophers for guidance here. Give us some sort of key takeaway lessons from them that help you reach for moral clarity around these issues.
Sure. I think the Enlightenment gives us four crucial values that most of us have but perhaps don't appreciate as much as we could. The first is the right to happiness. And you have to remember, before the Enlightenment, people really thought that, stuff happens. If you get sick, well, it's probably a judgment of God. If you're poor, it's probably the same thing. The idea that if you work hard, do what you're supposed to do, you ought to be happy on earth and not have to wait until heaven. That's a modern Enlightenment idea. So that's number one, and it drives all of our claims for social justice and also for medical and technological development. The second one is the value of reason. Now, that's not to say we don't care about feeling. It's to say that in matters of public policy, I don't get to say, God told me to invade a country. Well, maybe he did and maybe he didn't, but that's not an argument. I've got to put out my argument in terms that we can all discuss, and they can't be, well, some authority told me so, whether it's God or whether it's some other authority. So that's the value of reason. The third is the value of reverence, and I think it's particularly important both for believers and for non-believers to realize that gratitude for the fact of creation and the sense that human beings are limited, that we are not all there is a very important attitude to have towards the earth, to have towards other human beings. And finally, the value of hope. Hope is not the sense that the world is necessarily getting better. It's not necessarily getting better, but it can get better if we're convinced that we can play a role in it. So those are four Enlightenment values that I think we can all share.
You've been very tough in this conversation on some of the expressions of conservative values, even while granting that they've sort of carried the vessel when a lot of the left seemed to turn away from it. But you're tough on the left here, too. You say that your book is trying to reclaim moral concepts that the left no longer uses with full voice, that without them, quoting you, we will lose our souls, we'll also lose our footing and our young. The language of the left has been called the language of suspicion, not to get fooled again. Such language, you write, will never win hearts, nor very good minds either.
Correct. And this goes back to the point you were making about air quotes, which is another point that I make in the book. If you look at people on the left and look at their own hesitation in using all of those concepts, I think you'll see what I mean. So one of the reasons why I wrote this book was to try to provide some sources of common grounding where people can be proud in the idea of heroism, where you can see that you don't need to be a military hero to be a hero, and in fact, you may not want military heroism at all. There are other kinds. I talk about contemporary people who I view to be examples of Enlightenment heroism, and my guess is that everybody, if you think about it, if you don't view heroism in these life and death absolute terms of somebody who has to die tragically or at least be tortured in order to come out a hero, you'll find that most of you know somebody who you believe to be heroic and who is an example for you and for the rest of us.
Your own cousin, Sarah Chase, who used to be with NPR, now working in Afghanistan, a kind of personal hero among those you cite there. But interestingly, you say, when you look at Bill O'Reilly and Bill Bennett and say, look, you may not agree with them, but they reach millions who are desperate for some talk of values, and a lot of progressive politicians just haven't delivered on that front.
That is correct. Bill Bennett, who also wrote a book with the words moral clarity in the title, but wrote this big book of virtues, I believe it's called, which I have seen on the shelves of very good progressive-leaning non-intellectual people who simply say, I want to read this to my children. These are things that I want to give to my children. This is not to say that there are no children's books written by progressives. Of course there are. But I find it interesting and disturbing that virtue is a word. Of course, in philosophy departments, there are all kinds of debates about it. But if you look at the kind of mainstream political commentary or mainstream, mainstream political commentary, there's a lot of hesitation in talking in those terms. Think about the number of times you've heard the word noble lately.
Not too many.
Okay.
Maybe it's the times. Let's get a call from Lake Placid, New York, and Jane. Jane, you're on the air with Susan Neiman.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Tom. Just first want to say I just adore your program. I'm a big fan of Jack Beatty, and I'm so honored to even have a chance to be on the same line with Dr. Neiman. I just simply want to mention the Ten Commandments. I think the fact that the president thinks it's okay to lie is not a very good moral. I think that the fact that McCain is faced with a Times article, New York Times, within the last week about lying, I think isn't too good. I think that's what you're really after in the show. But I think the Ten Commandments say you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't be greedy. I think that's the problem with what's happened with Wall Street. And my feeling is that this country has lost its moral sense of right and wrong. It is wrong to sell something to an unwary person asking for advice as a stockbroker when you know it is not a good thing to buy. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Jane, thank you very much for your call in Lake Placid. I've got another from Blacksburg, Virginia that may resonate there. Dwight, you hear what Jane has to say. She's thinking, she says, look to the Ten Commandments. You'll know all you need to know. What do you say, Dwight?
Tom, he said the same thing I was going to say. You know, Susan says the Bible's complex, but I think it's simple too. It's just like the last caller. You know, the Ten Commandments. That's Judaism, Islam, and Christianity too. You know, it's just very simple. It's like Judge Judy says. Also, too, I know a lot of people don't listen to Judge Judy, but I think a lot of the folks in America, she says every third person you meet is stupid. So it's very simple. If anyone, you just go by the Ten Commandments in all three different religions, just like here in America, if we'd go by the Ten Commandments, you know, thou shalt not kill. Look what we've done in Iraq. I am a conservative Christian. I voted for George Bush. But, you know, he's an idiot. And that's just my personal opinion, and I think people ought to go by, you know, God gives us a free will to do the right thing. I have a daughter that is a financial wreck, and I keep telling her, you need to do the right thing. You need to pay your bills. You won't have bad credit. You know, the Ten Commandments tell you, you know, it's simple. It's just like Susan said, it is complex, too, the Bible is. But if we go by the Ten Commandments as Christians and Jews and the people in the world that actually go by the Ten Commandments, if we would just follow them, you know, and do the right thing, God gives us the free will to do that.
Dwight, we wish your daughter luck with her finances, and thank you for your call. Susan Neiman, Dwight says it's simple. You have the Ten Commandments and maybe a little Judge Judy, but there's... And there's complexity too. But are you ready to go to that level of simplicity in your prescription for moral clarity for progressives, Susan?
Well, I think that the Ten Commandments are a great source of orientation. I think that they, like any law, need to be applied. The reason why we have courts, a Supreme Court, and the reason why religious law has people trying to work out the interpretations, you have to apply them to particular cases. So, I mean, that's where things can get complex. But where I certainly agree with the last two callers is that I think this administration, it's interesting, has violated every single one of the Ten Commandments with the exception of coveting one's neighbor's wife. And so we really want to sit back perhaps and think, you know, is that the most important of the Ten Commandments? Or if they've violated all the other ones, how are we going to wind up judging them?
Jack Beatty, you're listening to all this, and we've all been watching the campaign. Susan Neiman sees in Barack Obama somebody who maybe in a Kantian way, you know, helps channel a moral dialogue. But she also acknowledges Republicans, conservatives have been a lot more effective in offering a gathering call for people who are hungry for moral messages. Where do you see the progressive front on that front, Jack?
Well, I think it actually can, and I think Susan says this, can start with Kant, who the other thing the Enlightenment gives us is the idea of there can be an ultimacy of values even for people who don't believe in God. And Kant gives the example. Kant says, all right, suppose you're threatened with death, and the only way you can avoid it is to sign a statement that'll have somebody else, an innocent man, killed. Probably all of us, to save our lives, or most of us, would do it. But we would all know what the right thing is. Mm. And that moral intuition is sublime. That is transcendent. That's not God. That's our nature. And that split between what is and what ought to be. We know what is, but we also know what ought to be. It seems to me that should be the basis of progressive politics. We have moral intuitions about what ought to be. People ought not to be hungry. They ought not to work for pittance. They ought to have health care. These aren't matters of just materialism. They're basic props of human dignity. And I think that is a way for progressives to talking about the gap, closing the gap between what is and what ought to be based on our own moral intuitions about what ought to be, about what's fair.
Susan, can a Kantian moral intuition flag compete with the flag of religion as a rallying point for morality in political arena?
Well, absolutely. I think the two can reinforce each other in just the ways that Jack was suggesting. And I think that Abraham at Sodom and Gomorrah was exactly Kant's idea of a moral hero who said, you know what, I'm going to speak up in defense of any possible innocent people.
So, hey, wait a minute here, God.
That's right. Even if it should cost me my life, I am going to stand on the side of the innocents. So I think the two, contrary to what a lot of people think about modernity or Enlightenment philosophers, I think the two reinforce each other if you read them properly. And I also think Jack's use of the word dignity is extremely important. What you feel in the moment of that thought experiment where you say, you know what, I could defy an unjust tyrant, even if it cost me my life, you feel a tremendous sense of human freedom and dignity, and you want to defend that and work for the possibility of that in everyone. And that's a fundamental value that progressives and I think conservatives can unite on.
Do you feel our politics at large, broadly, coming out of an era of polarization toward an era where conservatives and progressives may be able to have a richer conversation? Is something changing the progressive camp or conservative to make that possible? Or is there still this gulf in readiness to use the language, readiness to engage these concepts that holds the sides apart?
You know, I have to say that was one of the things I found so exciting about Obama's candidacy is that he was, let's drop the word reaching across the aisle, he was reaching across the country for shared values. And it's been a moving and terrific campaign. The choice of Sarah Palin was a choice to revive the culture wars. And you've seen it in this us versus them rhetoric ever since the Republican National Convention, which is really not about uniting or finding common ground, but about dividing. And I find it terrifying. My hope is that Obama will continue not, I mean, yes, the economy is in a crisis and it's got to be dealt with. But I very much hope that he won't, go in the direction of it's the economy, stupid. But indeed, as Jack himself was pointing out, economic values can be moral values. And to focus on that would be a genuine healing, a genuine sense of progress. Mm. And I hope for a return to the America we all love.
Here's to a good moral conversation on all sides. Susan Neiman's new book is Moral Clarity. Susan, thank you very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Jack Beatty, wonderful to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.